Welcome to Rooted and welcome to my yellow bench. I'm Liv Cropper and we will be exploring in today's episode the human side of sustainability leadership with Eliza Moskalin, who is currently Executive Vice President of Sustainability and Foundation at Sage, which is the payroll, HR and financial software company. So with Eliza, this conversation, I think you're really going to enjoy because what she gives us is a fantastic insight into the conversations that go on inside boardrooms and around the top tables of big organizations. And she talks about power and she talks about influence and she talks about building trust and relationships over many, many years. And we hear her talking about the ripple effect that's created when you really bring on board those executives, get them to care about sustainability issues, and then wonderfully see them go on and leave a legacy of their own, tackling those same issues within their own work. And we also talk about careers in sustainability, that kind of non-linear career path. It's not as mature an industry as a profession as many others. So it can be more difficult to navigate at times. We talk about finding the right environment for you and your kind of temperament and being really alive and aware of that. And we talk about, you know, yeah, dream big, but also be prepared for it to feel tough at times. And it is a difficult profession. And Eliza shares with me some of her thoughts about how it's a profession that's gone through a bit of an identity crisis and why that might not be such a bad thing. So let's dive in. Tell me what you think when we get to the end. I'd love to hear your reflections and hear your thoughts. Here we go. So today's guest on Rooted is Eliza Moskalin. She is Executive Vice President of Sustainability and Foundation at Sage, the payroll, HR and finance software company. She's got around 15 years experience across the ICT and finance sector in a whole range of global and local roles around corporate sustainability. She's previously led sustainability and ESG at Santander, and now she also contributes a lot to the sustainability profession. At the moment, she's a visiting fellow at the University of Edinburgh. She's held lots of other different board and voluntary roles in the past as well. So I'm delighted to welcome you to Rooted, Eliza Moskalin.
Hi, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me. It's lovely that we can do this. And I was just reflecting that we met a very long time ago, but haven't really ever properly spoken in depth. And I'm really looking forward to this. As I said to you when we were chatting about the podcast beforehand, with Rooted, it's not really a technical sustainability conversation, although, you know, we can go there a little bit if it helps. But really what we're trying to do is talk about the human side of sustainability leadership. So we're talking about the highs, the lows, the challenges, and really, I guess, all in the ultimate aim of offering some insights or some thoughts for our listeners that might just prompt them to reflect or think about things a bit differently. Or help them in their work.
Yeah, no, that sounds amazing. Yes, and I think definitely not the profession for the faint-hearted. So looking forward to exploring the highs and especially the lows.
With that, let's get started with right at the beginning, perhaps, for you. I'm really interested in, looking at your career journey and your kind of CV so far and looking at where you began in your sustainability career. But can you tell me a bit more about where your roots in sustainability began and what really drove you into this work?
Yeah, so I actually didn't know it, but I think it all started when I was 16 years old. And I went to Ecuador as an exchange student. I won a scholarship and went there to live in a very little village in the middle of the Andean. It was an extraordinary opportunity. I come from very humble backgrounds and actually always thought that, poor me, I can't go to holidays and all my friends, the typical poor European. And then, we had some little hardship like, getting to the end of the month and switching off the heating. And so I always felt like, So and then I went to Ecuador and I met this little boy called Jorge, who cleaned shoes in the plaza, in the square of the village, 7-year-old, cheeks burned by the sun, hoping to become a doctor one day and had to work to feed the younger sisters, 7-year-old, yeah. I think about that. And for me, the penny dropped. I felt very silly at that moment because I always felt like, very humble backgrounds, but poor European. And I realized that already being born in Europe, I had won a lottery. I also realized how much opportunities I had compared to that young boy. And for me, that moment also, as a young person, realizing how unfair the world was, kind of stayed with me. With the dreams of a young person, I left then Ecuador a year later with a mission of changing that, giving a better future to Jorge, try and mend and close those inequalities and fight for a better world. I didn't know that sustainability would have been the answer. I went on, I studied diplomacy tried that world for a bit. It wasn't really for me. Amazing parties and, of course, very important job, but I felt I needed to be much more on the ground. And then I stumbled, as I was doing the graduate program in Vodafone, into what at the time was called CSR. I fell in love. It was a love at first sight, I would say, because I realized how I could have an impact and how I believe, this, companies hold a lot of power, probably now more than ever, and a lot of capital. And if we could have them working more sustainably, ethically, we would start delivering a much more equitable and fairer world. So that's how I it started. It started without me knowing. It had started with a search for purpose when I was very, very young, and then stumbling across this profession and really falling in love for it, despite all the struggles that this type of work and profession then brings with it, because it's not a linear path, I would say.
And I mean, that it sounds like that experience in Ecuador was so formative, really, for you in terms of really giving you that context that you, and that perspective that you hadn't previously had.
Yeah, it was absolutely, on many aspects. So living in a developing countries, and also as a young person, it really formed the way I think. It helped me at a fairly early age appreciate that things can be looked at and explored from a different perspective. I think one of the big gifts beyond everything I said and the purpose that it gave me is also the ability to adapt more and understand that the same object can be looked from different perspective and look fundamentally different. I learned through a lot of mistakes, I would say, in Ecuador, what it takes to be interculturally aware, operate in a place that's not yours, and how do you get things done? How do you move? But it gifted me the appreciation of the richness, the diversity of thought and cultural backgrounds bring to the table. And that is something that I hold dear. And I think it has enriched my life and professional career in an incredible way.
Yeah, and I mean, so, some people, when I ask this question, they talk to me about nature, or you know, and various kind of environmental depletions that they've seen earlier in life, or that they've enjoyed the outdoors and things, and that often leads them into the kind of environmental sustainability or biodiversity kind of angles. Would you say that, you know, through your work, you that the social sustainability, the S of the ESG, has always had a really big part in the work that you've done? Is it kind of that early injustice and inequality and poverty that you saw, has that really kind of carried through your work?
Yeah, I think it was the starting point to some extent because I experienced it from a very young age. As I said, I come from very humble backgrounds, first to go to university and so on. And as a kid, I always wondered why that was the case. My parents worked very, very hard, so why wouldn't they have the same access to opportunities? But then for me, Ecuador kind of did it. And then, of course, this is very early in my life, right? As I grew up and then started in the sustainability world, my agenda has always included a very strong component of climate. And I think that is essential, and it's core to what I do as part of sustainability. I think the climate crisis is possibly the biggest and most defining challenge of humanity. Although AI is kind of getting there now, but I think that overall the threat that that climate change poses to humanity. And the future of our children is something quite scary and urgent for us and our generation to really resolve. Then of course it has a number of implications in terms of also the climate justice and all the social aspect. They're all interrelated. The reality is it's hard to draw a line between social and environment, that they're all very much one of the same. And I don't think you can fix one without fixing the other.
I'm interested in the work that you've done through your career, and I wonder what, when you look upon the different roles that you've had and the initiatives or the work that you've done, what you feel most proud of? Where do you feel you've made the greatest impact?
Yeah, so I could talk to you about a number of projects I've been involved in and made me proud, and I could see the impact on the ground, or longer term impact. But there is one theme that for me is the has the biggest impact, and it's very intangible, which is when I can see that executive teams, board members have changed their minds as a result of the work that we've done.
Right.
And so, as opposed to, and we can and we should probably talk about some of the amazing projects I've had the privilege to work on and be part of. But I think for me, the bit that makes me most proud and I can see has the biggest impact is when I see a CEO or board member having the aha moment, and starting to take decisions based on new information or sort of a new point of view, driven by me and my team. And I think that that has a multiplier effect. It's kind of has ripples then, because these people typically don't sit only in one board, and they have a very strong sphere of influence, and it's pretty intangible. And it takes a long time to see, and sometimes you see it years after you have done the actual work. It's quite interesting. It's one of those hard to measure, but I think it is one that I believe really makes a difference.
Can you think of any examples of, I think, what it was that eventually shifted the dial for this individual might have been that piece of work? Is there any times you can make a stronger link or?
Yes, and I don't think he'll mind me naming him, but the ex CEO of Santander Asset Management, Jeff Scott, he invited me on one on his offsites. And I trotted in that room full of asset managers, hardcore directors, his leadership team, right? And led a session that morning. And it was interesting. It was one of those. And I did my thing, trotted there and do a training and do a session, do thought-provoking things. And since then, he's been completely devoted to the cause. He's now the chair of a Rewired Earth, which is a startup that looks after how can we find better ways to measure and track, almost label sustainability products and services to direct capital better. He's done a whole bunch of things. He's become one of the biggest, my biggest, I think, advocates and allies in this journey. And I can't take, I wouldn't say that's been, oh, that's all me. But he did say to me that that morning, that session was some, it was a session that I walked, that it was a bit of an awakening. Then, of course, it's all on the individual and their own levers and what he's gone on and done that I can't take credit for. But what I hope I can take a little bit of credit is that little awakening, that little moment of connection that goes like, oh, actually, there's something in here. And we're still friends. He's one of my big allies, a bit of a mentor, I would say. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, but the person I also go to when I go like, okay, how would I convince this person now that you're a converted? So
That's wonderful. It's just a lovely story. And I think in this podcast, we've sometimes talked about when I ask about what kind of drove you into sustainability, where did you sort of start your journey? Sometimes people talk about that kind of oh shit moment of like, oh my God, somebody's just presented the facts to me and done it in a way that's particularly thought-provoking, and I've connected the dots, and oh my God, like I've now realized what the task is and what the problem is. And it's just wonderful, I think, that you know, this is you delivering that moment to, this particular individual that's then spurred him on to all those other areas where he's made that impact and had that ripple effect.
Yeah, and I think that as I said, I can take a little bit of credit. Then a lot of thing is down to the individual, and I think Jeff is a particularly enlightened human being. So I had a quite easy ride, I think, in the awakening, and his own personal journey. But I think I had other moments or so in terms of, some are a result of very well delivered maybe, and in a session or conversations or a series of those where eventually the penny drops because you present the right information in the right way at the right time to the right people. But sometimes it takes years. So another person that I will mention is again the former CEO of Santander. Great again, leader, someone I really enjoyed working with. And we had, though, our moments where, I was trying to drive a bit of a change in the foundation. And I've worked both on sustainability and foundation. And I always felt foundation could do more and becoming much more strategic and working a bit on an intersection. And it took a bit to convince him because, of course, the foundation is very loved, was very loved by colleagues and was delivering a number of initiatives that colleagues loved. But for me, they were quite tactical as opposed to being truly like able to drive change. And eventually we turned that around and took a much more strategic approach at the intersection with sustainability and foundation. That what that meant was, as opposed to just, for example, supporting the charities and that colleagues just love, we selected charities that we believe could be critical friends and help the bank do the right things. So for example, Santander is a very, as a retail bank, some of the customers were older age customers. So we partnered with Age UK and we partnered then with Alzheimer's Society, and they really helped us to think about that audience and how could we be a far more accessible bank. A very similar journey now at Sage. So when I joined Sage, which is an accounting software company, we had a fantastic 10 years tenure foundation. And it just to give you a sense, the engagement rate is more than double than the industry average. So typical engagement is 20% in the industry, and we were like 50% of colleagues engaged. So really loved foundation. And once again, trotted in the CEO room and said, "I want to change this." And it's and you get this look of, "Why on earth would you change something that really works?" So. Leave it be, which is fair. And I must say, both Nathan and my current CEO, Steve, we kind of had a good, you know, discussions as to why and if. And I must say, I've been really lucky that both CEO gave me, you know, took a bit of a leap of faith. I could see from their faces they were like, "What is she talking about? Oh my gosh, she's gonna break this." But okay, fine. I mean, you seem very convinced, so go off and show me. And so also with the foundation at Sage, we went from very many programs that were, you know, a foundation that was loved but fairly inwards looking, and lots of initiatives that ultimately were done, you know, volunteering, very on the ground, very hard to then say, you know, what impact have we had. My team very busy trying to organize these events. And now we have, what we have done is creating basically a program that still delivers that, but in a much more self-serve basis, and designed a program that is called the Social Sage Impact Entrepreneur Program, and that's about helping small medium businesses that are social or environmental, and helping multiply their impacts. Sage works with small medium businesses. That's what we know. Who we know, that's where we've got most of our assets, our technology, our know-how, our connection. So we're basically taking them under our wing and trying to multiply their positive impacts. And the outputs of these are being phenomenal. So now, going back to the original question, right? Both CEOs, these are examples where I had an influence, but it took years to gain their trust, to convince them. And to be honest, I think in that tension also, they both were kind of in the back always of my mind to say, don't lose the heart, don't lose the people, don't lose the colleague. And then has helped us really to reach to design something that I think is a bit in the middle, because if they had said, "Oh yeah, sure, absolutely, just go off and do it," I would probably get all the way, and probably I would have lost that heart, that engagement, those colleagues. So I think that is one where I would say I have influence, but I have been influenced, and I think that's equally important and impactful, because I think, you know, it's a very good it helped me shape and land probably something that works better than it would have been had they just said, "Sure, Lisa, go off and do it." So yeah, sometimes is you know, the right conversation. Sometimes it takes years to actually see a difference.
And I mean, you know, you're talking about these executives taking often quite a leap of faith with your proposals. Yes, they're shaping them a little, but you know, they're taking a leap of faith. And it's because of that trusted relationship that you've built over so many years. But do you know what I'm thinking is that we have sometimes on this podcast talked about and talked with people who are in the like independent consultancy space or even, you know, in the consultancy space and kind of coming in and doing an engagement and then coming away again. And it just kind of speaks to me of the importance of having, if not everybody there who's been there for a long time, at least some of the people there and the leaders of the team who've got that opportunity over a number of years to build up a long-term trusted partnership with the executive. It kind of, you can't outsource that to a degree, or it doesn't feel so easy to outsource that. It kind of speaks of the value of having those trusted partnerships in-house. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
It depends. I mean, think about John Elkington. He has worked as a consultant and he's been incredibly, incredibly influential. And so I think that as a consultant, what you do have is the opportunity to be far bolder. And of course, there's always, at the end, you have to make the client happy and you've got that constraint. But you also are external and can afford to be slightly more provocative if you want. The problem is with consultants, you're right, you come and go. You come, you do or say what you got to say, and then you go. And it's up to the team. But I must say, I have worked with consultancy firms throughout of all my career, as everybody has, but they have found in that very, very amazing allies. So again, another person, John Williams, he's been a consultant his whole life, but he's been a fantastic, he was in-house before, which was one of his strengths when he was a consultant after. And he's been an amazing ally, because sometimes I put him in the room to say the things I didn't want really to say. So, and because he's a consultant, you know, he can be a bit more controversial, or also it's received differently than if you are a sustainability practitioner going in the room to the CRO, the chief risk officer, and saying you're missing something is possibly, you know, it's challenging. I'd say that. But having a consultant who was an ex-CRO, who has worked in the sector, who understands and speaks the same language of the same CRO, saying, what I'm observing is this, so you may want to consider this, because otherwise you may be missing something, has a completely different impact.
Yeah.
So I think that it's more about partnering with also
it's that people, blend. Yeah.
Yeah. And Liv, sorry, you gave me just another idea, and this may make you smile. Also, pressure groups have their own role. So I think that, and I wouldn't say maybe we partner with them, but I remember there was a time where I was actually really cheering for them throwing eggs at companies, because I think that creates some of the pressure that then lends the sustainability professional into the chairman room to say, how do we stop them throwing eggs at us? So everybody, I think, has their role. And typically when I have, you know, people reaching out and saying, oh, I would like to work in sustainability, I do ask, you know, what's your style, what are your motivations, so what's the environment you work at best? Because if you are someone who just want to say what they think, doesn't take any compromise, and is not afraid of controversies, and then possibly the pressure group is a better place versus someone who's a bit maybe more diplomatic and pragmatic and can stay there for the longer term, then corporates are probably a bit. But we need all of those, because none of us will succeed in our own isolation.
And one of my questions that I would come to is, and I'll maybe ask it now, is your kind of seed of wisdom or your advice for others in this profession. And perhaps you're kind of suggesting there, it's thinking about your natural talents or your natural inclinations, and thinking about the environment that's best suited to that. Would that be your kind of biggest piece of advice, or are there other things that you would share with others?
So the first thing I would say, it's not for the faint-hearted. And I think that is an important reality check, because I've seen many people coming and going into this world, coming with either at the very beginning, you know, when this was still CSR, with an idea, oh, I'm going to do good and I'm going to be on the ground doing amazing things, and then getting disappointed because it's yet another corporate job, and it is a corporate job. So they were then a bit disappointed and frustrated with that. I've also seen people coming in and expecting a very linear, straightforward career progression, career path. That's not the case. You need to be quite entrepreneurial to progress. It is possible, but it's definitely slower and more frustrating than if you are a HR person. And I'm not saying, by the way, that HR is simple, but I'm saying that there is a very clear...
It's more well-trodden.
It's a much more mature profession. It's been around for many years now. There is a clear career path. You go, you be a business partner, you then become you go into center of expertise, and then eventually there is a path for you to become a first line of the CEO. Now, come to sustainability, there are very few CSOs that are first line to the CEO. And that's not because of lack of talent. It's not because they're not talented people. It's just because it's not linear. It doesn't yet exist. So how many CSOs are in boards where fewer than people with accounting and financial background? Because that's how the system is and how it works. So I think that going in, dreaming big, determined to make it through and break the glass ceiling is important. But also being conscious that it won't be easy, that it will take longer, that it will be slightly frustrating. I think it's an important thing. Otherwise, I have seen people burning out or people giving up sooner than maybe it was, or you know, just being disappointed, which is a pity because they had the talent. And maybe had they gone in with clarity and a bit of that reality check up front, they would have gone further. So I think it spares a bit of disappointment. It's tough. It's a tough gig. But I also think you need, because of that, I believe it needs the best people.
Yeah, and I do often see, so I think when you get to a level within sustainability where, you know, you've been sustainability director at maybe a number of companies, it's sort of that there is that question, okay, well, what next? And if you don't want to try and become the CEO, and as you say, that's a pretty difficult leap to make, what next? And I think people within sustainability are often quite driven by impact, and they're driven by legacy. So they can kind of, it's really trying to find, you know, what's that role where you can make an impact? And that might not necessarily be a more impressive sounding job title, or even a bigger pay packet. It might just be a job with the opportunity to do something quite cool or quite interesting or quite different, or make a big splash or a big impact. So yeah, I think that the driving forces of people in this profession is sometimes a little bit different from other professions where, as you say, there's more of a well-trodden path.
100%. Whenever I hang out with my peers and other CSOs, it becomes quickly apparent that what you described is exactly what people tend to aspire to. And it is that ability to influence and make a difference. I do believe that there is a correlation between that and the job title and the paycheck. And I think the market should reflect that. Because the reality is, if you are an ExCo member or a board member, you have a lot of influence and ability, because you've got the resources, the access, the visibility. So I do think that there is a correlation. So I don't think it's just, I want to do good, and so it's okay to tuck them under. Why do sustainability professional aspire to become a first line of the CEO? Because they want to influence, because we want to drive change, because we want to embed into the way that the company thinks aspects that aren't typically part of those discussions. And it's much easier to do if you have a seat around the table. At the end, it's about also power. So I think that I would hope that, you know, we are at uncertain times, and it is at the moment a geopolitically challenging context for the sustainability profession. But I would want to believe in what I've seen. You know, I've been doing this before it was fashionable, far before it was fashionable. So what we're living today is not different and is still better than what it was, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So I would believe that, you know, politicians come and go, but climate change stays, inequality stays. And most importantly, the need for companies to be resilient, to have a business model that can generate revenues and good results in a sustained period of time remains. So I think that we are back at the business case. We're back at, we believe that this is not just the right thing to do. If you move beyond what is the moral imperative, and, you know, people have different moral imperative, and that's okay. But it is the smart thing to do for a business. It is really what can make your business resilient. And look, I had the privilege to work in Kenya when I was with Vodafone. And I worked in Safaricom, which is a subsidiary in Kenya. And I saw there the power of bringing sustainability closer to the business. I work on M-Pesa. I can't take any credit for it because it was there before I joined. But M-Pesa, for the ones who know, is a mobile money platform that has completely revolutionized the way that financial services are provided to the lower part of the pyramid, so the bottom of the pyramid, to the people that are typically, unfortunately, excluded to financial services. And it's been spectacular. And if you read the story of M-Pesa, it all was born from a sustainability kind of initiative aimed at, you know, stickiness and saying, let's, you know, people in Kenya want to send money home. They are people who work in the city, want to send money to their villages. They often get robbed. They have to pay a lot of money to send that money. That's unfair. It's financial exclusion at its worst. So why can't we maybe use a normal phone to help them transfer that money? And M-Pesa was born, and today it represents 20% or more the revenues of the company. So it's a fantastic business case that drives financial inclusion as well as revenues. And I think that is possible. It just takes a slightly different mindset.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, sort of championing these stories and these cases where these the business imperative and the social and the environmental kind of imperative all kind of collides and comes together, and making sure that the stories are known and set up as examples that we can look towards. What would you say, as you look on your career today, what would you say have been the real toughest times? Like what's felt the hardest for you, do you think?
I mean, following on this thread of thought, right, because we talked about the beautiful instances in which the business case comes along with the sustainability case, and you can, you know, then it's easy. It's a win-win for everyone. Why not? And it's still hard, but you know, I think what I find hard is the times where I need to guide the leadership team through decisions that are not straightforward, or ask them to take decisions for which I know the market will penalize them. And there are instances in which, like, the markets operate, the financial markets operate on a short-term basis. It's quarterly results. And some of the decisions we have sometimes to take, although there is absolutely a longer-term business case, and they may not deliver on the quarterly basis. And having worked with leadership teams for a bit now, and having had the privilege to have a CEO who coached me and kind of helped me see what the position they're in, I became much more sympathetic I think that earlier on in my career, I would take a stance saying, no, you're the CEO, so why can't you just make this happen? Why can't you, you know, just take this decision? And then you understand that also CEO has a boss and they have constraints, and you understand that they operate, you know, as long as they're delivering the results that the shareholders expect, they may have a bit more maybe license to do other things, take bigger risks, or maybe take a longer term decision. But whenever the markets are not that favorable, it's very hard. It is very hard. And I mean, recently, and I cannot disclose the details of it. It wouldn't be right. But we have been, you know, we looked at our net zero trajectory, and I knew when we're looking at some of the decisions we have to take that, unfortunately, I was putting the executive team in a position where I know doing the very bold, very kind of environmentally, forward-looking thing won't thank them in the market. And then you have to balance that, because the reality is, what good are we as a company if the work that I do sinks the company? If as a result of some of the decision, if they don't help that financial sustainability business case, and as a result of some of the decisions, we have to fire people. I'm not saying that we are there, right? But if you look at some of there will come a time we'll have to take on price. And that's where I see things like policies, regulations, and being helpful, because they create a much more leveled playing field for executives and enables them. Because it's interesting, sometimes I think executives, teams, or CEOs are seen as, because they're only interested in money. No, it's because they are incentivized, and the whole system is creating in a way that does not necessarily always incentivize longer term gains. It's not necessarily a patient system. So we do need, and as I think what I find hard in my profession is that you have to constantly navigate that tension, and it's a bit of an art to make sure that you push as far as is correct to push, and then help executives sometimes when it's the right time to take those bold decisions, and some other times you have to actually maybe coach also your own team to say, guys, this is not the wisest time for us to do that. And I think especially now in such a complex, volatile geopolitical context, having that kind of a bit more mature view of it's not all black and white, and we do need to navigate uncertainty is important.
It reminds me, you said earlier that you do need to be you need to have that self-awareness of the kind of environment and the kind of way that you thrive and do your best work, in the sense of, if you are somebody who is more black and white in your thinking, or more kind of, I suppose there's an element of, if you're more dogmatic in how you approach things, then, working within the constraints of a big corporation that has shareholders and investors and all sorts of people and other stakeholders to consider, it's going to, and there's going to be these trade-offs that you're going to find very difficult to tackle. Whereas if you are someone who is somewhat more inclined to be more pragmatic in how you do things, then it's perhaps somewhat easier to manage these trade-offs, I guess, at times.
Yeah, well, I think that the reality is, for sustainability professionals, it's always hard, because your heart is always in that future place where you want to be able to say, I saved the planet. But so to some extent, I'm lucky. I have in the team some people who don't hold back. I've got some also climate scientists who are absolutely brilliant and make me feel very, very uncomfortable. And I think having that tension is very, very helpful, because then they push us and push me harder. And then it's my job to make sure that their message is delivered and is consumed, and then makes others uncomfortable at the right time. And then my job is kind of help also take those pragmatic decisions, but with that consciousness of, okay, but this is kind of, to some extent, there's what sometimes we say is like, we need to be sure there's nowhere to hide, meaning that we need to provide the executive board with a lot of clarity about what are decisions we're taking, what are the trade-offs. And then some of these decisions are leadership decisions, are decisions that need to be taken in that boardroom. And it's our job to then do the best with those and try and continue driving that agenda. But yeah, I think that that's how you stay grounded. And definitely we are going through a storm. I do believe it's a storm. But I think our profession is at the time, I think this is an opportunity as well. I think that you may find surprising, but I agree with some of the ESG backlash. I watched with a certain level of discomfort when in the past 6 years we've seen a bit of a hype around sustainability and purpose, and some of those hyperbolic statements driven by very well intended marketeers or PR people. But sustainability is not PR, it's not about the headlines. And I think it may have gone a bit too far. So I feel this may be a bit of a correction. And for me, this is a time of sobriety and an opportunity for us as professionals to go back to the basics of, well, it's always been about the business case and sharpen that business case, but also sharpen the practice. The sustainability in the grand scheme of things, it's not accountancy, it's not an old profession. It hasn't been around for hundreds of years. So I think that also the concept, has been, since the 70s it depends. But it's been well established since a while. The profession in itself hasn't. So we're still maturing and growing. So I would like to believe that this is an opportunity for us to mature. And I am taking it as a really great opportunity to reshape also our role and reflect on where is and how is that we can have the most lasting impact. And I do think it comes back to rigor, variety, clarity, commitments that are close to the business case, and the rigor of the practice that for me, it's always been there. But I think during the hype, you've seen people going a bit maybe beyond what has always been the core of sustainability.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about that. And I think, many people that I speak with built their sustainability careers in that time of hype, began their sustainability careers in that time of hype. So, if it's the change that we see, feels quite stark and quite difficult. Those people who've got a longer history with the profession have seen the ups and downs and have seen that overall development and maturity, as you say, it's perhaps you can take a different perspective on it. But I do think people have found it difficult to go, okay, this is not the profession I thought it was, it's something else, and what is it? And that's really the bit that's developing and, as you say, maturing. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I often say I did this far before it was fashionable, and I started on the ground floor, literally next to the bean store, and with my friends from IT, we were both on the ground floor, and it slowly raised through the ranks, and I was happy to see that. But I do think, as you said, so I recruited my teams. I've built sustainability teams during the hype, I found it very, very hard because I was going, when I started, it was very hard to find anyone who had any credentials, and I would receive lots of people from CSR and grants giving and all that foundation type of background. And then during the hype, my goodness, I would receive so many applications with people that had added sustainability to their title in the past 12 hours on the back of a course and an alleged kind of awakening to this was the purpose they've always looked for. And it was interesting because I actually intentionally never hired anyone who I realized had just added the title when they found it, basically during the fashionable bit of it. And it was very quick and easy to scratch through the surface and understand the ones who had actually substance and understood what this really is about. And those are people who will go, you know, technical, robust, deep subject matter expertise with whom you can, it's, if you've done this, you know you're talking to, you scratch the surface at the third question, you go like, no, you are talking ideas, you're not talking like, you know, when you, it's very, actually was quite interesting. And to some extent, you feel bad because you're like, I love the enthusiasm.
Yes.
But enthusiasm, it's not enough.
Yes.
Same way that when you know, choose your chief information about the CTO, you don't go like, yeah, you love technology, but that's not enough to make you the CTO of this company. So it's very, very similar. I think sobriety is a good thing for the profession. And I hope that we get to the other end of this time with a much stronger practice.
Yeah, I love that. So yeah, the idea that enthusiasm is good, but not enough. Sobriety, maturity, and that rigor and technical, deep technical expertise is what's needed to kind of reshape the profession going forward.
And business acumen, because I think that ultimately, if you do sustainability on corporates, you do need to understand how corporates work.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And be okay with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that has been such an interesting conversation. I feel like I've just been sitting here nodding and nodding. And the listener won't know that I'm just going, yep, yep, yep. and nodding away with everything you're saying, because it's just so, yeah, the wisdom that you have from these roles that you've done is just fantastic to listen to. So thank you.
Lovely. No, thank you. You don't get very often, you know, in a busy executive career and life and yeah, family, and you hardly ever get the opportunity to sit back and reflect, which is, yes, very, very important. So actually, really enjoyed, and thank you for the opportunity and good questions that actually made me think. And you took me all the way back to when I was 16.
So. I sure did. Yeah. It's where it all starts, right? It's where it all starts. And it's so good to know where it starts, because it helps you understand the choices and the decisions that you make later on and what's kind of driving it. It's always a good place to start right at the beginning. So yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me. I really do, yeah, appreciate your time on the Rooted podcast, Elisa. Thank you.
No, likewise. Thank you very much.
So there we are. There's my conversation with Elisa. I loved talking to her. I loved getting to know her better. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And I hope you found something there in that conversation about those influential moments within boardrooms or within executive teams, and whilst they are challenging, how incredibly rewarding they can also be at times as well. So hope you've got something from the podcast. I feel like we are starting to really build, this is episode 7 now, I think, and we're really starting to build a nice little community of people who are listening to all the episodes and giving me feedback. And it's really lovely to hear from you when you message me and tell me what you think. So please do continue doing that. I also have a request for you. If you've been listening to the podcast today and you've enjoyed it, and perhaps something along the way has resonated for you, can I ask you, will you share it with somebody that you know who for whom it might also resonate as well? Share it with a friend or a colleague or somebody you've met along the way who's in this profession, and tell them what you've enjoyed about it. I would love to spread the word just that little bit more. And I'd love to continue to build this community of Rooted listeners that we're creating. So thanks so much for listening. Please do like, follow, subscribe, comment, all of those things. And I'll see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.